the unknown.
Mystery.
Space.
Science.
Have fun.
Adventure.
Suspense.
Fantasy.
Nameless, unreasoning, unjustified terror.
Welcome to Journey number 122, featuring the capture of John Wilkes Booth. I am your guide in this journey, Marshall Latham, coming to you from base camp in Turner, Oregon. That's right, we're back here with the companion piece to our last journey, which was the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. So we're essentially 2 weeks later. This is April 26th. 1865. There's been a great search and manhunt for the man responsible for that assassination, John Wilkes Booth. And so, without further ado, let's hear the reports. So come with me, and let's journey into a small barn in the southern state of Virginia.
Hinckley wrote a last letter to Jodie Foster. I'm doing all of this for your sake, it said. I'm asking you to please look into your heart and at least give me the chance with this historical deed to gain your respect and love.
Well, I didn't know for quite a while until they began to tell me about the young man that had done this. And what his problem was, that he was not exactly on a normal basis. And so then I added him to my prayers, that prayers for myself, that, well, if I wanted healing for myself, maybe he should have some healing for himself.
The Pope forgave the man who shot him. You forgive John Hinckley?
Yes.
Oswald, did you shoot the president?
I didn't shoot anybody, sir. I haven't been told what I'm here for.
Do you have a lawyer?
No, sir, I don't.
I like some legal representation. These police officers have not allowed me to have any.
I don't know what this is all about.
I killed the president.
No, sir, I didn't. People
How'd
keep
you
asking
get the
me that. Sir?
Did you shoot the president?
I work in that building.
Were you in the building at the time?
Naturally, if I work in that building, yes, sir.
Back up, man.
No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in the Soviet Union. I'm just a patsy.
Lee Harold Oswald has been shot. We saw no one fire the shot, only a blast from some bullet here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Oswald fell to the concrete in front of our eyes and immediately was covered by police officers who took him quickly, immediately, instantly from our sight.
I shall never forget to my dying day the look of anguish and despair on that man's face as he half dragged and half limped to the center of the stage, with a wild maniacal stare brandished the knife above his head and cried out, "Sic semper tyrannis!" Thus perished tyrants. He managed to get out to the stage entrance, mounted his horse, and drove away.
This is Don Hollenbeck of the War Department in Washington. The Secretary of War has just released the following statement this 26th of April, 1865, and I quote it, "The War Department has received an unconfirmed report that John Wilkes Booth The assassin of President Lincoln is in the vicinity of Port Conway, Virginia. Lieutenant Baker and Colonel Conger, two of the ablest agents of the United States Detective Bureau, have been rushed to Port Conway with a detachment of cavalry, signed Edwin M. Stanton, unquote, and end of statement. Port Conway is about 50 miles directly south of the nation's capital in Confederate territory. It's a small town on the north bank of the Rappahannock
River. April 26, 1865.
Port Conway has never
wanted, dead or alive, John Wilkes Booth.
The most tragic manhunt in the history of the United States approaches its grim climax. CBS takes you back 84 years. The Civil War has ended. President Lincoln has been assassinated. North and South alike, shocked and appalled, wait for the capture of the man who killed him. Wait for the end of a bitter calamity. All things are as they were then, except for one thing. When CBS is there,
you are there.
You are there. Produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyenne, is based on authentic historical fact and quotation. And now,
Washington, a corridor in the War Department, and Don Hollenbeck.
Today, it may see the capture of the well-known actor who only 12 days ago stole into a box at Ford's Theater here in Washington, fired a ball into the head of President Lincoln, and escaped. John Daly and Ned Kellner are in the area of Port Conway. They've been covering the manhunt with a CBS mobile unit, and we expect to hear from them momentarily. There have been charges that the federal government has been lax in its efforts to capture Booth, charges that Lincoln's assassination is part of a conspiracy that reaches high into the government. In the face of those charges, Secretary Stanton and the entire War Department are exerting their utmost efforts to end this manhunt, and today may see the break they've been waiting for. Quincy Howe has had a chance to weigh the possibilities inherent in the report that John Wilkes Booth is in Port Conway, so here is Quincy Howe.
Let me emphasize first that we have no confirmation yet for the report that John Wilkes Booth is in Port Conway, Virginia. During the past 12 days, we've had rumors that Booth was in Pennsylvania, that he was on board ship going to Europe, that he was in Maryland, in Canada, in Mexico, in fact, practically everywhere on the North American continent. But all these rumors, when nailed down, proved to be false, even fantastic. If, however, this report proves true, then the question arises, can Lieutenant Baker and Colonel Conger get to Port Conway in time to catch Booth? Never forget this. Booth is not standing still. He's desperate. He's on the move. The farther south he goes, the safer he becomes. Even suppose Baker and Conger do reach Port Conway before Booth gets out. Will they be able to capture him? Remember, they're in Confederate territory. Will a hostile population reveal Booth's whereabouts? And finally, how will these two detectives from the north stack up against the Confederate guerrillas? Although General Lee's army surrendered some days ago, many Confederate batteries have not yet stopped fighting. Mosby's brigade, for instance. Just a minute. John Daly and Ned Kellner are already in Port Conway, Virginia. Go ahead, Port Conway.
This is John Daly. John Wilkes Booth is in this vicinity. He was here in Port Conway yesterday afternoon, may still be here now. Lieutenant Baker, the detective in charge of this searching party, told me that much a moment ago. Our CBS mobile unit is at the dock of the Port Conway ferry, and Lieutenant Baker is inside the ferryman's shack questioning him. Ned Kellner has been given permission to go inside, and the moment anything develops, he'll come out and tell us. To piece together the story of what happened when the cavalryman got here, I've asked one of these young cavalrymen to talk with us. His name is Tom Williams. He's a sergeant. His home is in Yonkers, New York. Tom, you fellas rode into town about an hour ago. What happened when you got here?
Well, as soon as we got in town, Lieutenant Baker and Colonel Conger started asking everybody we passed if they'd seen Booth anyways around here. Nobody said they didn't. I don't know whether they were lying or not. But they just kept on stopping and asking people. And finally, down the road a ways, we stopped an old colored fella, and Lieutenant Baker showed him some pictures of Booth and the other fella. Harold was supposed to be with him, and...
You mean Davy Harold, the stable boy who helped Booth escape from Washington?
Yeah, Harold, that's him. And this old colored fella said he'd seen him and Booth here in Port Conway yesterday. He said Booth stopped and asked him if there was a ferry across the river, and he told him how to find it. Well, when we heard that, we rode up here to the ferry on the double.
Well, Tom, what cavalry regiment is this that you're with?
We're a detachment from the 16th New York.
Did you volunteer for this mission?
No, we were detailed.
Any particular reason?
I guess because we're sharpshooters.
Oh, I see. Then are your orders to shoot Booth on sight?
No, we'll shoot if we have to, but our orders are to try to take him alive.
Do you think you're going to get him, Tom?
Sure, we'll get him. Nobody can do what he did and get away with it.
Well, Tom, if you fellas do capture Booth, do you think you'll get part of that $100,000 reward?
I don't know about that. The only thing is, we got to get him, that's all.
All right, thank you, Tom.
Sure.
There's still no word as to what is happening inside that shack where they're questioning the man who runs the ferry. Here beside me now is another man here in Port Conway. He's Mr. Harry Murdoch. Mr. Murdoch, you're not a Virginian. You don't live here in Port Conway, do you?
Oh, no. I'm a Yankee from Chicago.
How do you happen to be here in Port Conway?
Well, I just happened to be in the vicinity, and I heard the report that Booth was supposed to be around here, so I came to scout around.
What do you think? Will they find Booth here?
Well, I don't know. I really don't know. I have a hunch he's not around here. This whole thing is just another wild rumor.
Oh?
Yes. I've been trying to tell Lieutenant Baker that, but he won't pay any attention to me.
Well, what do you do, Mr. Murdoch? Your occupation?
I'm a private detective. Murdoch Bureau of Investigation.
I see.
286 Wabash Avenue, Chicago.
Yes, well, the government has complained that you private detectives have been giving them false clues and wrong leads to deliberately throw them off Booth's trail.
Oh, that's not true. Oh, there may be one or two unscrupulous operators in the field, so it's a case of the innocent being condemned to the guilty.
Well, I don't suppose, Mr. Murdoch, that with a $100,000 reward at stake, you'd mind getting Booth first, would you?
Why, sure, that's only natural. But I'm trying to do everything I can to help the government.
Uh-huh.
I'm sincere about this. That's why I've been trying to tell Lieutenant Baker that he won't find Booth in this neck of the woods.
Well, Mr. Murdoch, where do you think Booth is hiding?
Well, there's no doubt about it. He's over in Lower Maryland. He could hide in that swampland for years and they'd never find him.
Well, if you think Booth is in Maryland, what are you doing here?
Oh, as a matter of fact, I'm on my way to Maryland. I'm just passing through.
I see.
I saw the cavalry ride in, and I don't want them to lose time here when they could be somewhere else.
Yes.
See, I'm a very sincere...
Excuse me, Mr. Murdoch. They are coming out of the Ceremon Shack. One or two of the soldiers have just come out. And here come Baker and Conger. They have the ferryman with them. Baker has his revolver jammed into the ferryman's back. Lieutenant Doherty has called in the sentries. He's ordered the men to get ready to move on. Here's Dick Palmer.
Wilkes Booth is not here in Port Conway. He's somewhere across the river. He's heading south toward a town called Bowling Green. The ferryman here, his name is Rollins, took Booth and Harold across the river late yesterday afternoon. The ferryman said that two Confederate soldiers crossed with Booth and Harold, and he said he heard the actor boast to the soldiers that he had assassinated President Lincoln. The ferryman also revealed that Booth must have hurt his leg. He's hobbling on a homemade crutch. His leg is wrapped in an old muddy bandage. Also, Booth has shaved off his mustache. Lieutenant Baker got this information from the ferryman at the point of a gun. And now the cavalrymen are going to cross the river. They're getting their horses aboard the ferry boat. They're going after Booth in the direction of Bowling Green. And John Daly and I are going with them. So now back to Don Hollenbeck in Washington.
So the manhunt goes on. Lieutenant Baker has definitely picked up Booth's trail now, but Booth is 24 hours ahead of the cavalry, and the question is whether Booth is in Bowling Green now, and if he is, why. There's perhaps one person in the country who might know the answer to those questions. Doug Edwards is with him in New York, so over to Doug Edwards.
I'm in the home of the distinguished actor Mr. Edwin Booth here in East 19th Street, New York. Mr. Edwin Booth is a brother of the hunted John Wilkes Booth. And Mr. Booth, before any questions are put to you, is there anything you'd like to say?
Mr. Edwards, when a nation is overwhelmed with sorrow by a great public calamity, the mention of personal grief would, under ordinary circumstances, be an intrusion. But under those by which I am surrounded, I hope that a word from me will not be so regarded. It has pleased God to lay at the door of my afflicted family the blood of our deservedly popular president. Crushed to earth by this dreadful event, I am sensible that other mourners are in the land. To them, one and all, go forth our deep, unutterable sympathy, our abhorrence and detestation of this most foul and atrocious crime.
Mr. Booth, do you know of any special reason why your brother should go to Bowling Green?
I don't know, Mr. Edwards. John was very popular wherever he played in the South. He had many friends there. But I know of no reason for him to go to Bowling Green, except the hope that some of his Confederate friends might offer him sanctuary.
Mr. Booth, would you tell us something about your brother? Many of us have seen him in the theater, but what is he like off the stage?
John was a wild, scatterbrained sort of boy, quite impulsive and theatrical. John is vain, self-conscious, too handsome for his own good, hot-tempered. Yet I've known him to be kind, gentle, full of fun, and I was happy that he was my brother. He was always his mother's darling, and this has crushed her heart and spirit.
Mr. Booth, do you have any idea why your brother killed President Lincoln?
He was insane. Insane on the subject of Lincoln. John's sympathies were always with the South, and he blamed Lincoln for all the South's troubles. I recall the day I told him I had voted for Lincoln. He flew into an insane rage and screamed at me that Lincoln wanted to be king of America. I imagine that the news of Lee's surrender drove his mind beyond the limits of reason.
Mr. Booth, somewhere in Virginia, at this very moment, they may be capturing your brother. Have you any comment to make?
I am sure that God will not permit him to go unpunished. He is my brother, but it is far better that he be dead than prolong this shame and humiliation by a public trial.
Thank you, Mr. Booth.
There is something I would like to add, if I may.
Yes, Mr. Booth, say anything you like.
I would like to say, for my mother and sister and my two remaining brothers and myself, that we pray that our loyalty as citizens will be judged by the record of the past. For our present position, we are not responsible. For the future, I shall carry a heavy heart, an oppressed memory, and a wounded name. Dreadful burdens. To a too welcome grave.
Thank you, Mr. Edwin Booth. You mentioned that there are other mourners in the land. Some of them, at this moment, are in Little Falls, New York, waiting for the lonesome train, the train carrying the late President Lincoln to his last resting place in Springfield, Illinois. Ken Roberts has been on that train since it began its sad journey. We take you to him now aboard the lonesome train at Little Falls, New York.
The lonesome train is on a siding a few hundred yards up the track from the depot here at Little Falls, New York. It stopped a moment ago to take on water. Soldiers are standing at attention alongside of each car, and on the ground, in the gloom, are a handful of people, men and women. This lonesome train has passed through many of the great cities and heard the eulogies of high dignitaries, but here, behind these sad faces, are the farmers, the shopkeepers, the little people of whom Lincoln himself was one. They're standing here silently, their eyes running the length of this dimly lit six-car train, always pausing at the third car, which they know holds the casket of their beloved late president. Well, there's the train bell warning that we'll be moving in a minute. Now the soldiers of the honor guard are climbing back up into the cars, and this funeral train is about to continue its lonesome journey westward. Someone has begun to sing. Spontaneously, simply. It's the battle hymn of the Republic. Now others are joining in. Let's listen. Is getting help from some Southerners, and the big question now is the attitude of the entire South. How far will it go to help Booth escape? There's one man who might speak for the South. He's the former president of the Confederacy, Jefferson Davis. Mr. Davis is in the custody of federal troops in Irwinsville, Georgia, but he's consented to make a statement, so we switch you now to Irwinsville, Georgia, and CBS correspondent Arthur Hannis.
Mr. Davis, what is the South's feeling about the assassination of President Lincoln by John Wilkes Booth?
I would like to say, have it fully understood, that the South does not, nor will it ever condone this cowardly, villainous act of John Wilkes Booth. I'll give you my assurance that the assassination of Lincoln was not plotted, nor given implement or comfort by any member of the Confederacy. History will prove that it was a conspiracy of certain congressmen to dispose of Abraham Lincoln and place a man of their choice in his place. All decent and honorable people in the southern states are shocked. Shocked by his murder. Booth is no hero to us. He will be no martyr to the Confederacy. He will receive no welcome among the gentlemen and women of the South.
Thank you, Mr. Jefferson Davis. John Daly and Ned Kelmer have reached Garrett's farm, so we switch you to our mobile unit somewhere near Bowling Green, Virginia.
This is John Daly. The cavalrymen have surrounded the barn here at Garrett's farm. It's a small barn, only about 20 by 30 feet. Booth and Davy Harold are almost certainly in there. They were locked in by the young Garrett boys who were afraid they might steal their horses. When the cavalry came up, they roused the Garrett family and quickly found out that the two men Willie Jett had brought to the farm were still here. Lieutenant Baker has ordered young Garrett to open the barn door. Now Lieutenant Baker is speaking.
Inside the barn! Come out! Do you hear? Come out! Give yourselves up! Or we'll set fire to the place and burn you out!
That was a voice from inside the barn, a man's voice calling out, "Who are you and what do you want?" It may have been Booth's voice, if he is inside.
I'm being taken by my friends. Who are you?
this mad flight. A barn door is opening now, slowly. I can't see anyone yet. Yes, now someone is stepping out.
Grab him, man, grab him!
Two soldiers have grabbed him. They're bringing him up here to Lieutenant Baker. He's just a boy. Can't be more than 19. He seems to be giggling strangely and fumbling. Colonel Conger, who is it? Is it Harold?
It's Harold, all right. Bobby's still in the barn.
Is Poof in the barn there with you?
Yes, sir. But I didn't do nothing. I always liked Mr. Lincoln's jokes. Honest, I swear, I didn't do nothing.
Take him over there by the house. If he moves, shoot!
As you can hear, Baker is calling into the barn again, and for the first time he has addressed Booth by name.
We know you're in there! Come out! And surrender!
Behind the door, just a step. I can't see. There's a shot.
Fire that shot!
A shot.
Wilson
fell into the floor of the barn. Maybe he shot himself. He said he'd never be taken alive. Baker and Conger have just rushed into the barn, and the barn is an inferno. It's going up quick. The dry brush has sent the dry wood afire, and flames are climbing up into the sky, but they're carrying Booth out now, taking him a little ways up from the barn. Hey, let me through here.
Stand back! Stand back!
The guard won't let me through. A man is blocking my way. Booth is lying on the ground about 15 feet away. He's not dead, but he seems to be in agonizing pain. Blood is running down the back and side of his head. Baker and Conger are bending over him. His lips are moving. He's having difficulty breathing. And now Lieutenant Baker has gotten up. He's coming over this way.
Lieutenant Baker! Hey, Lieutenant Baker!
How bad is Booth?
He's dying. We can't save him.
Joe, get the guard over here. But, Lieutenant, I saw his lips move. What did he say?
He said, tell my mother I died for my country.
He was shot in the head, wasn't he?
Yes, behind the ear. And almost the identical spot he shot Lincoln.
But was he shot by one of your men, or did he shoot himself?
I don't know. That's what I'm going to try to find out now.
All right, Joe.
Oh, wait a minute.
Wait a minute, Lieutenant. Yeah. Are you certain that it's really Booth?
Of course it's Booth. Harold said Booth was in the barn with him. Besides, I've identified him positively.
Well, you just heard Lieutenant Baker say, without qualification of any kind, that the dying man is John Wilkes Booth. No one around here seems to be very happy. There's no anger, no spirit of revenge. There just seems to be a sense of a grim job that had to be done.
April 26, 1865. John Wilkes Booth, the man who shot Lincoln, is captured and dies.
You have been listening to The Capture of John Wilkes Booth, another broadcast in the series You Are There, produced and directed by Robert Louis Cheyon. The Capture of John Wilkes Booth is written by J. Franklin Jones. Edwin Booth was played by Richard Waring, John Wilkes Booth by Scott Scottsworth, and the cast included John Sylvester, Raymond Edward Johnson, Charles Webster, Matt Crowley, Guy Sorrell, James Dobson, and others. Next week,
January 7th, 49 B.C., Caesar at the Rubicon. You are there.
Tonight, the hit parade on parade comes marching to CBS to take over the Jack Benny spot for the summer. The hit parade on parade brings you specially modernized versions of the highlights of the hit parade's outstanding programs of the past. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
So there you go. There's the report of the capture of John Wilkes Booth, as told to us by CBS News, because together we were there. Well, I really don't have too much intelligent to say at this point, or ever, I guess, really, but I'd like to get right into the comments of Simon Salt, who, as you know, is our resident historian here on the Journey Into podcast. Simon lives in Atlanta, Georgia, and he's lived there for the last dozen years or so. Before that, he lived in England, and he's excited about both European and American history. So let's hear what Simon has to say, and the rest is history.
Simon Salt, and this is The Rest is History. This episode, we're going to continue with a look at the Abraham Lincoln assassination, and in particular, the hunt for and capture of John Wilkes Booth. As you would have heard in the last episode, John Wilkes Booth had been planning to kidnap and then eventually had decided on executing the President of the United States. And he'd done this for a number of reasons, primarily because of his love, as he saw it, for his country, that being the Confederate States of America. In fact, amongst his dying words were that he requested his mother be told that he had done what he had done for the love of country. So he truly saw himself as a patriot. He saw himself as a man of action who took the necessary action to avoid the country coming under the rule, his country coming under the rule of the North and the abolitionists. This was about slavery, but it was about more than that. As I mentioned in the last episode, John Wilkes Booth was an extremist in his views. He was a strong nativist, believing only that natural-born Americans should hold public office. He was anti-Catholic and anti-immigrant. He wanted much stricter controls on immigration, and he did not want to see Catholics in any position of power. This was not an uncommon sentiment at the time. Primarily, Americans at the time doubted the loyalty of Catholics because of their allegiance to the Pope in Rome, who some mistakenly thought of as being the head of a foreign power, and therefore their allegiance couldn't be both to the Pope and to America. So he was a conflicted man. He was an actor, but after falling sick and leaving the stage for a short period, he became increasingly obsessed with ways in which the South might still win the war. And in fact, a few weeks before the assassination, had planned to kidnap Lincoln and hold him for hostage for either a peace on Confederate terms or for the release of Confederate soldiers. But as I mentioned in the last episode, he was not alone in this act. He had several co-conspirators, some of whom failed entirely in their task and some of whom only half succeeded. The assassination attempt on Secretary of State Seward was botched. The assassination attempt on Andrew Johnson didn't occur at all because his would-be assassin lost his nerve and spent the evening drinking instead. And there was no assassination attempt on Grant, though it were planned that there would be. So really, only Booth had the courage of his convictions and the opportunity to actually carry out his part of the plan. His fellow co-conspirators had, in some cases, been agents for the Confederate Army and had acted as spies in place in the North, passing information, in the same way as John Wilkes Booth himself had done. John Surratt, the daughter of Mary Surratt, was one of these, and John Surratt was, in fact, one of the only conspirators to not be found guilty at trial. He had escaped America and was later found in Alexandria in Egypt, and the jury could not decide on his guilt, and he was set free. He lived until 1916. The others all suffered a very similar fate to Booth. Mary Surratt, who had owned the boarding house where the plans had been drawn up and who was herself a conspirator and spy for the Confederate Army, was the first woman to be executed by the federal government. She was hanged alongside three of her male conspirators. And so the conspiracy ends with John Wilkes Booth and one co-conspirator, Herod, being tracked to a small shack in Virginia. And they were surrounded. John Wilkes Booth had broken his leg and whilst on the run had that set by a doctor who was sentenced to life imprisonment for his part in helping John Wilkes Booth. His sentence was later suspended by Andrew Johnson. He was set free. But over this period, 12 days, they spent on the run in the swamplands of Maryland and the rivers of Virginia, trying to find a way to get into the deep heart of the South, where they felt they would be hailed as heroes and protected. During this time, various people were aiding Booth and Herod. And in fact, at one point, Booth is given copies of the newspapers, all of which are condemning him, all of which are talking about the manhunt, all of which are talking about his heinous crime. This came as a huge shock to Booth, who felt that he should be hailed a hero. And he thought, truly thought, that the newspapers would have been on his side. They were not. He was tracked down to the Garrett farm and the shack. He was surrounded by a detachment from the 16th New York Cavalry, numbering about 26 men. They arrived in the evening and shouted to the shack that the men inside should come out. Booth wanted to know who it was that was inside. And as you heard in the recording, the reply was, "It matters not who we are. We know who you are." So for Booth, this was it. This was the end. But in fact, he had known this in advance. His journal survived him. One of the few things that did survive of his. And he had written in it, 5 days earlier, the lines from Macbeth that he must fight on for the cause. He saw himself right to the end as this heroic character, almost as though he were acting out a play, almost as though, in Shakespeare's world, words, his world had become a stage and he were a player upon it. And so he went through this. He decided he would not surrender. He would die fighting. And that was his plan. He wanted to die fighting. So he allowed for Herod to leave, bargained for his release, and Herod was taken prisoner. And, of course, was later executed along with Mary Surratt. Booth decided that he would not come out and he would stay and fight. In fact, he said he would fight them single-handedly, but he would not surrender. Suddenly, a shot rang out. Who fired that shot is still unknown. It is supposed, of course, that somebody from the detachment of the 16th New York Cavalry fired the shot, having seen Booth by a window. It's unclear if that were the case. Some people thought maybe he had shot himself, though that is unlikely as he was shot in the back of the neck. Regardless of who fired the shot, they then set fire to the shack. Wounded, exhausted, and suffering obviously from smoke inhalation, Booth crawls to the door and is pulled clear of the building. He's carried to the porch of the farmhouse at the Garrett Farm and laid out. And he survives for a few more minutes. He asks that his mother be told that he did what he did for the love of country. And his dying words, as reported at the time, were to look at his hands and simply say, "Useless, useless." He felt he'd failed. He had failed to achieve what he was really aiming for, which was not just to assassinate the president, but was rather to upend the Civil War, to give the South another fighting chance, to allow the South to rise again. He failed. He failed in his attempt and instead created a martyr for the North and for the Union. So what can we learn from history and John Wilkes Booth? Well, he was, in the end, a lone gunman. Even though his co-conspirators felt that they could, in fact, carry out this conspiracy and help their South rise, they were not able to. They weren't the kind of men that Wilkes Booth was. And that was passionate, enraged, and extreme. He was obsessed with both the ideal and his role in it. And when you get those two things together, you get a very, very dangerous person. John Wilkes Booth goes down in history as the first assassin of a US president, becomes reviled and hated, and becomes an example of how the passion and conviction, even false conviction, of an ideal can lead ordinary men to behave in deranged ways. This is Simon Salt, and the rest is history.
Thank you, Simon. Appreciate your comments as always. I really appreciate the things that Simon's able to bring to this podcast and his insights on these historical events. It's a lot of fun. One thing that Simon didn't talk about was there's several claims or theories that John Wilkes Booth was not killed, as depicted here in this story, and as talked about, that is the official government line, and that John Wilkes Booth actually escaped and went to India and came back to the United States years later and eventually committed suicide in the state of Oklahoma. I didn't want to talk a lot about that. I don't know enough to speculate. You know, it's funny, no matter what event in history happens, there's always, always going to be conspiracy theories, and people think that we're not getting all of the story and that there's a massive government cover-up. And I'm not saying that the government never covers up anything, because I'm sure they do all the time. But if the government was able to cover up and hide so many things that are claimed to have been hiding, then our government is way more efficient and competent and capable than we ever gave him credit for. There's so many things, whether it's the moon landing or 9/11 or, of course, JFK, you know, those types of things. There's so many conspiracy theories. Roswell, New Mexico, all those things. And there's always some interesting tidbits, as there is in this claim of John Wilkes Booth surviving and living in disguise for the rest of his life. But the other thing I wanted to talk about, hopefully I won't take too much time, but you know, last time I talked about the attempt to kill President Ronald Reagan, and we talked a little bit about the JFK assassination. Those are the most well-known that I can think of. But looking at it here on the internet, of course, so I'm getting my information. I've read it other places, but I liked this website. It's called presidentsusa.net. Like I say, I've heard this and read this in other places, but this seemed to put it together nicely, and so I can put a link to this in the show notes. But there were some very interesting historical tidbits in here, I thought. When we think of U.S. president assassinations, we immediately think of Abraham Lincoln and John F. Kennedy. Understandably so, I would say. But there was actually two other presidents that have been killed. Of course, Abraham Lincoln was the first in 1865. James Garfield was killed in 1881. And he was going through a train station. He was in Washington, D.C. at the Baltimore and Potomac Railroad Station. and he was shot from behind as he was walking through the station. But he didn't actually die from... That was in July. I guess I should give the dates here. That was on July 2nd in 1881. But he didn't actually die from that gunshot wound. He died in September 19th of the same year, essentially from infections and blood poisoning that occurred while the doctors essentially tried to locate the bullet and extract it from his body. And in their attempts to find the bullet, he received infections and blood poisoning, and he eventually died in September. So it was about 2 months between when he was shot and when he died. And so that was a little bit harder. That was a little bit more suffering and not an instant thing, as in the Lincoln and Kennedy assassinations. Then again, in September 6th of 1901, William McKinley was also shot. He was greeting the public at the Pan American Exposition in Buffalo, New York. And he was shot at close range. And he died about a week later of gangrene caused by the bullet wounds. So again, the medical profession and the conditions that people lived in the late 1800s, early 1900s, was a lot different than what we have now. It sounds like Garfield and McKinley would have survived their shootings if they had lived today, similar to Ronald Reagan. Aside from actual assassinations of presidents, there were several attempts made on presidents' life. But this one's fascinating to me. This is back in 1835. This is Andrew Jackson. And he was at the U.S. Capitol in Washington, D.C. And a man approached him and tried to shoot him with a revolver, but his gun misfired. And so that attempt failed. And Andrew Jackson actually started to berate the man with his cane because he was so infuriated that the man would try to shoot him. The man actually had a second pistol, pulled it out, and shot at the president, and that gun misfired as well. Just amazing that the statistical probability of two guns misfiring, preventing the assassination and death of Andrew Jackson is just amazing. And I can just think of, last time we talked about some time travel stories, and, I could just fashion a time travel story around that, somebody preventing the assassination of Andrew Jackson. That's just amazing to me. Here's another interesting one. In 1912, Theodore Roosevelt, who was, very gregarious and he was the old Rough Rider, and he fought in the Spanish-American War and was just very full of life and very full of himself in many ways. He was going to give a speech in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And he was leaving his hotel, and a man fired a gun. And this was actually after Theodore Roosevelt had been president. But anyway, so this man fired at former President Theodore Roosevelt, but the bullet was slowed because it hit the papers that contained the speech that Roosevelt was going to write, was going to give from the speech that Roosevelt was about to give, and it also went through his glasses case. And so that slowed the bullet enough to where he wasn't seriously injured. And he went on to give that speech. while he was bleeding from a gunshot wound, he gave the speech and did not go to the hospital for evaluation. And that just, is true to form to the type of guy that Theodore Roosevelt was. When Franklin Roosevelt, FDR, was president-elect, meaning he had won the election, but he wasn't president yet. He was in Miami, Florida, and a man fired shots at the car from which Franklin Roosevelt had just given a speech. Roosevelt was not hit, but the bullets hit others, including Chicago Mayor Anton Cermak. And he was killed. And that was, I'm sorry, that was in 1933. Then again in 1950, at the Blair House in Washington, D.C., Harry Truman was shot at by two gunmen. It says here that two gunmen unsuccessfully attempted to obtain entry to the Blair House, where Truman was staying as the White House was being renovated. A gun battle with the Secret Service and other guards commenced, and one gunman was killed and the other wounded. Truman was unharmed, but one White House police officer was killed. Gerald Ford in 1975, so now we're getting into my lifetime. In Sacramento, California, a woman attempted to fire a gun at Ford as he was approaching the California Capitol. A Secret Service agent noticed and prevented her from firing the weapon. Gerald Ford again, twice in the same month. So that was September 5th, and this is on September 22nd, 1975. Upon leaving the St. Francis Hotel, another woman fired a gun at Ford. All the shots missed, and Ford was unharmed. Women did not like Gerald Ford. And that's all the ones that it talks about here on this website. I don't know when it was last updated. But we do know that there was a attempt by Saddam Hussein to kill George H.W. Bush, 41st President of the United States. There was also a couple, I think, minor attempts to attack the White House when President Clinton was president. I think somebody tried to fly a small plane into the White House. I think another person tried to run past the gates and to shoot and had a gun trying to get into the White House. I don't think those were major threats when Clinton was in office. But when he was in Manila, there was an attempt to blow up a bridge that he was going to be driving over. So there was that attempt. George W. Bush, I think there were a couple attempts made with him as well. I guess the closest one was when he was giving a speech in the country of Georgia, not the United States, Georgia, but the country of Georgia. He was giving a speech there, and it says that the would-be assassin threw a grenade toward the stand where the president was giving his speech. And, you know, two things saved President Bush at that point. One, it was 30 yards away, I guess. Apparently it was about 30 yards away and it was beyond the effective range of the damage that the grenade would have done. But to conceal the grenade, it was also wrapped in a cloth, a handkerchief or something like that. And it was so tight around there that even though the pin was pulled, the grenade was never engaged. President Obama, according to Wikipedia, has had several threats and people talking about trying to kill him, but never anything seriously effective, at least as that we know of. The one thing there is that he had Secret Service protection when he was just a candidate to be president. According to this, Secret Service protection for Obama began after the senator received a death threat in 2007. This marked the earliest time a candidate received such protection before being nominated. Security was increased early for Barack Obama due to fears of possible assassination attempts by white supremacists or other racist groups against the first African-American major party presidential nominee. And I can definitely see where that would be a concern. You know, way back in the 80s, you know, Eddie Murphy was predicting that, you know, if there was ever a black president in the United States, that he would be constantly ducking for cover.
He won't stand still!
You know, that was part of his comedy sketch, but, you know, I think he felt that way. And so it's interesting that President Obama received protection against assassination attempts when he was a senator and had announced his presidency. I think now, in this day and age, it's pretty much assumed that there's going to be attempts on your life if you're a president of the United States. Sad but true, and I don't know, that may have always been the case, that when you become president of the United States, you're putting yourself, or public office in general, I guess. But you're putting yourself, your life at risk, and that's why there's the protection there of the Secret Service. So anyway, I've gone over my allotment of time here. The unofficial buzzer has rung, so I'm going to let you go for today.
Oh, and just in case you were wondering, I did look it up, and I am related to Abraham Lincoln. He is my 11th cousin, 8 times removed. To my knowledge, I am not related to John Wilkes Booth. But who knows?
Hope you have a good May. And since we have spent so much time in the last couple months here in America, our next journey into history is going to take us back to Europe. And it's going to take us back a few centuries. Get ready for that. And until I see you next time, be safe out there and journey on.
This is Julie Hoverson from 19 Nocturne Boulevard, and I'm here to tell you that the Journey Into podcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. This means that while you cannot change it or sell it, you are encouraged to share it, however, and with whomever you would like. The theme music for the podcast has been provided by Man in Space.
I declare, Mary, with that war between the states nonsense behind us, it feels good to laugh again.
John Wilkes Booth, halt, you insidious secessionist.
You're safe now, Mr. President.
What? Who are you?
Just a longtime admirer.
The glorious South will never be defeated! Say hello to John Wilkes Booth!